This is Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. Are you ready for summer? Are you ready to go swimming in Lake Michigan? Don't forget, Lake Michigan can be treacherous, and we'll find out more about that in a conversation with Dave Benjamin, who's the co-executive director of the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project. Drownings happen this time of year in Lake Michigan. Don't be a tragedy. Don't be a statistic. Find out more. We'll also talk with the professor at the Calumet College of St. Joseph, who, working with some students, is joining other student groups across the country and putting together some experiments that will go up in the next flight to the International Space Station. And we'll also have an update for you as well, information concerning the gray death, the latest opioid problem that we deal with in Northwest Indiana. Summer's almost officially here. The weather's warming up. That means the water of Lake Michigan is also warm up as well, too, inviting not only swimmers and boaters, but surfers as well, people who enjoy being out on Lake Michigan. But unfortunately, Lake Michigan is fickle and can be very dangerous and, some, unfortunately, to some people, fatal. And that is why David Benjamin, as well as his colleague Bob Pratt, executive directors of the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project, go out, talk to people, including youngsters in school, telling them how dangerous it is to be out there and not know how to handle yourself in case you find yourself in a drowning situation. So we've asked Dave Benjamin to come back on Regionally Speaking to talk about it. And thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Let's hear the bad statistics here we should know about. It's very, very common, unfortunately, for people to get themselves into trouble when they're out in Lake Michigan. What are some of the latest statistics, unfortunately, on the drowning situation this year?
Well, right now in the Great Lakes, there's 20 drownings that we're tracking for this year, which brings the grand total since 2010 to 557 drownings on the Great Lakes. And with Great Lakes drownings, about half of them happen on Lake Michigan, and then half of Lake Michigan drownings happen on the south end of Lake Michigan.
For people that aren't aware of it, why is the south end of Lake Michigan, of course, from the end that we happen to be on, why is it so dangerous?
I think part of it is going to be, one, the configuration of Lake Michigan. It's 307 miles from north to south, and we get the prevailing winds, which are coming from the north or northwest, which creates a lot of wave activity and dangerous currents on the south end of the Great Lakes. In addition to that, there's a high population that lives in the area from Chicago to northwest Indiana, southwest Michigan, and then with that, a lot of tourism, especially in the summertime, everyone wants to cool off and go to the beach. So it's just, a unique mix of high population and a location that can be dangerous, especially if you don't know what the hazards are. And if you don't know just the basics, that drowning is one of the leading causes of accidental death in the United States and the world. So most people don't know that. They might think, okay, we're going to the beach, it's like we're going to the park. But if you fall off the monkey bars, you might sprain an ankle. But if you get in trouble and water over your head, it may cost you your life.
One of the things I know that you have to stress whenever you talk to people about the subject, and as we mentioned at the start of the conversation, that includes talking with the young people at schools or in separate groups outside. I know, in fact, you've just completed a series of talks here not long ago over here in Northwest Indiana to alert them about the dangers of swimming in Lake Michigan and not being aware of the surroundings at all. When we get into these situations, is just the fact that people, like you mentioned before, they think it's like swimming in a swimming pool, although those could be dangerous too, but it's even worse when you've got that push of water coming out of the north, coming towards the not only the lakefront, but also, I guess, the beaches as well, too.
If somebody were to submerge in a pool, it's a contained body of water, and it's got high visibility or higher visibility than what you have in the Great Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
And so if somebody goes missing underwater in the Great Lakes, it's a large body of water. It's not contained. There's currents that could, drift the body in different directions. In addition, there's very, very low visibility. And so, if you don't have eyes on the water at all time, monitoring the people in the water to, actually know what drowning really looks like versus the Hollywood version of it, and witnessing someone in distress and being able to get something to them that floats immediately, then it's a huge, huge problem. And you know, what we want people to know is that with drowning, time is of the essence. If somebody is actively drowning, they're doing the signs of drowning, which is typically facing shore, mouth at water level, head tilted back, doing a climbing the ladder motion. There's not a lot of waving, yelling, and splashing. If they're doing those drowning response signs, it's typically less than 60 seconds until final submersion.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So if you don't have eyes on the water, and if you can't spot that person who's subtly drowning, it's very subtle, you're gonna miss them. And then people also need to know is once that person submerges, at 2 minutes, if they're recovered and CPR and artificial respiration is properly performed, it's about a 94% survival rate. But at 10 minutes of submersion, that survival rate's only about 14%. So how fast can you get something to them that floats? How long would it take to, one, realize the person's submerged, two, call 911, and then for 911 to pinpoint your location, to send dispatch, and for them to arrive? They're arriving past the 10-minute marks. So lifeguards really, really are the biggest factor in here. If we can have properly trained open water surf lifeguards who are monitoring the beach, know what to look for, and are, you know, physically trained to get out there and get flotation to that person. And then, you know, in the event that someone does submerge, being able to get to that last point of seeing at the water and then be able to do an underwater search and get them back up and on shore, you know, within a couple of minutes to get that CPR and artificial respiration going. It's very, very time sensitive, and people just aren't aware of that.
There are some great diagrams if you want to go to the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project website and take a look at these. One is entitled, How Does Drowning Look, or What Does Drowning Look Like? And the other one is an interesting description of the steps that you need to follow if you find yourself out there or if you're with other people who find themselves in this situation. Check it out on the website. Let's go through them, if we will, here, Dave. And you've mentioned some of the points already here. And you talked about the Hollywood view of drowning. I guess you think about, of course, the trailer for the movie Jaws, with the person floundering in water, and of course the great white shark coming up behind him or underneath him, whatever. That's not the way that drowning really looks like. Tell us about it.
No, and we more related to like the old TV show Baywatch, mm-hmm. where, you know, every episode there's several rescues in the episode, and it would be a long traumatic event where someone's at the surface of the water for 2 to 5 minutes, you know, yelling, waving, splashing, a long traumatic event so that they can cut to a lifeguard in a tiny bathing suit running in slow motion with theme music to, you know, then get in the water and make the rescue in time for commercial break. Unfortunately, that image of drowning as a long traumatic visible event, you know, translated into beach signs, and it would show, like, you know, danger of drowning, where it's like somebody in chest-deep water with their arms up in the air or waving their hands or yelling for help. And so we want people to know that drowning doesn't look like how drowning or how Hollywood has portrayed it, and that it's very, very subtle. That if somebody, you know, a distressed swimmer may have some ability to do some yelling or splashing, but they exhaust themselves pretty quick. And once their body goes vertical in the water, facing shore, mouth at water level, head tilted back, hyperventilating, you know, doing climbing the ladder motion with their hands are barely breaking the surface. I mean, it's dire. They need something. They need immediate assistance. Anything that floats, whether it's a life ring or a football or a volleyball or even a cooler, something that floats, they need it as soon as possible to interrupt the drowning process. Because once we, you know, as said before, it's very, very time sensitive. 2 minutes of submersion, it could be a full recovery. 10 minutes of submersion, it's likely a body recovery.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Dave Benjamin, who is the co-executive director of the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project, about the dangers of swimming, or surfing for that matter, and not being aware of your surroundings. If you're in Lake Michigan, some tips to know if you find yourself or if you're with friends and find themselves in the situation of drowning, and how to save your life, as well as your friends that might be with you as well, too. One of the diagrams that Dave, I know, is listed on the website and we've mentioned, you talked a little bit about some of the steps here. Flip, float, and follow. Tell us what that will designate and what, in turn, might help save your life if you follow that advice.
If you ever find yourself struggling in water over your head, what we advocate is that people flip, float and follow. It's the stop, drop, and roll of water safety. Mm-hmm. And how it works is you flip over on your back and you float. The emphasis is on floating. You float to keep your head above water. You float to calm yourself down from the fear and extreme panic of drowning. And you float to conserve your energy. And then you follow the safest path back to shore. So we want to, you know, really emphasize is the ability to float or to have something with you that floats, like a life jacket. Flotation is the key. If, you know, some people tell us, I can't float, we say, well, if you're in a drowning situation, do you want to live, yes or no? If you want to live, you must stay at the surface of the water and continue breathing for as long as possible for either rescue to arrive or until you are able to self-rescue and get back to shallower water where you can stand. We get the most confusion or questions about follow. What does follow mean? Mm-hmm. And follow means follow the safest path out of the water. And then the next question is, what's the safest path? And unfortunately, every drowning is going to be unique to the body of water, the conditions of the water, other waves and dangerous currents, to the water temperature, as well as the person's physical swimming ability and swimming endurance. So that's a lot of factors. So we want people to know that when you go to the water, if you get in trouble, you may have to follow the safest path out of the water, making, you know, that judgment call, what's the safest path out of the water in a life and death situation. And it may not be very easy and may be overwhelming. So continue floating. Mm-hmm. Float as long as possible. Flotation is the key. We cannot emphasize that enough.
Now, you mentioned about the fact that follow whatever the next step is to be able to save your life is difficult. And you've seen enough of these rescues that have happened on Lake Michigan, people that have managed to survive drowning incidents there, too. So even though you mentioned that every single case is different, it's pretty unique. Are there any common things that you have discovered in looking at these cases on Lake Michigan in particular that have, probably people can maybe keep in the back of their minds that if the opportunity presents itself, they can use that as following through?
Always take something with you that floats. You know, and you know, one thing we've seen is that it happens quite a bit is like people aren't aware of an offshore wind where the wind is blowing from land out to open water. And someone might get in a kayak or on a stand-up paddleboard or some other type of flotation device like a raft. And what happens is the flotation gets caught in the wind and starts blowing away from shore. And the further you get away from shore, the stronger the wind gets and the more turbulent the water gets and the colder the water gets. People often make a fatal mistake is, oh my God, I'm floating away from shore and it's this kayak in the wind. So what I should do is get out of it and try and swim back. The big problem is now you're getting into cold water over your head and your swimming ability likely isn't going to be able to get you back to shore. So we always say, always stay with the flotation device. Mm-hmm. Try and signal for help. So that, you know, maybe somebody with a jet ski or a boat or first responders with a flotation, you know, craft can get to you to make the rescue. But ditching the flotation device, you know, is a fatal mistake. Always stay with flotation.
Yeah, that's a very, very wise choice to make here. You have a chance to talk with a lot of people. We mentioned classes for schools or park groups and things like that about the dangers of swimming in Lake Michigan and some safety tips. You've just mentioned some here, too. How important do you feel and your colleagues there at the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project feel about having some kind of regular training or at least some kind of instruction in schools away from the lake, at least let them know about these dangers, so this way they might be prepared when weather warms up and they go out swimming?
It is absolutely essential to have a water safety school curriculum in place, not just in the Great Lakes region, but really nationwide. Mm-hmm. Main reason why is because people go on vacation. Wherever they go on vacation, there's going to be some type of water. You go to a hotel, there's going to be an unguarded pool. You know, if you go to, you know, Pure Michigan, one in five jobs is related to water. Everywhere you go, there's water. There's inland lakes, there's streams, there's rivers, there's the Great Lakes. And, you know, people really need to know what to do around water. And unfortunately, you know, we do two types of presentations. We do public presentations and we do, you know, like, say, school presentations. A public presentation is a volunteer audience. a school presentation is a captive audience. You know, mm-hmm. the kids are in school and they're going to that presentation that day. We've noticed that, you know, when we have a public presentation, we might get one person that shows up or 20 people that show up, or rare occasions, if we have a great organizer, we'll get 100 people that show up. Okay. And that's a very, very small attendance. Whereas if we go to a high school that has 2,000 students, we can see 2,000 students in the day. Now, when we have public presentations and we're inviting people to attend these public presentations, you know what the number one thing we hear?
What?
The number one thing we hear is that I know how to swim. I don't have to worry about drowning. My kids know how to swim. They don't have to worry about drowning.
Oh, that's what bad advice could you give? That's not wise.
And the harsh reality is that two-thirds of all drowning victims, 66%, are good swimmers. Okay? So there's a disconnect there. And I often say to people in reply, hey, I know how to run, but I couldn't run a marathon right now if my life depended on it. Okay? A drowning accident is a marathon for your life. It's not about how fast you can get out of the water. It's how long you can stay at the surface of the water until you can, you know, reach shore or rescue to arrive. And so we got to make that connection. And unfortunately, you know, one-on-one conversations is a very small way to make that connection. If we can get into schools and we can educate students the way that we educate for fire drills, tornado drills, school shooter drills, even earthquake drills. Schools in Illinois and Indiana have earthquake drills. Do you remember how bad the last earthquake was in Indiana? Because I don't remember in my lifetime if there's been a fatal earthquake.
Not around here. We've had ones that people have noticed, but that's only it, basically.
Right. And the big picture is, in my almost 50 years of lifetime, I can't remember a fatal earthquake in Indiana. But on average, in the United States, 10 people per day will die drowning. Okay? So there's a huge disconnect for the need for earthquake drills in schools versus the need for water safety in schools. And don't get me wrong, I'm not opposed to earthquake drills in schools. I'm simply saying we need to elevate water safety to the realm of other safety programs like fire drills, tornado drills, school shooter drills, and earthquake drills. Because the big picture of drowning is that it's likely that more school-age children will die drowning each year than die in fires, tornadoes, school shooters, and earthquakes combined. So it's time to wake up, America, and get water safety in schools. And, you know, one thing I like to mention mm-hmm. is we have conditional approval for a Department of Natural Resources grant that will provide 100 school presentations in Northwest Indiana for next school year. With that grant, we'd also be creating a train-the-trainer program, so instructional materials and videos, so we can implement it, you know, on a much wider basis, and all materials produced will be for use in the Great Lakes region.
That's great advice. Dave Benjamin is a co-executive director of the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project. Dave, thank you for the advice that you've given today. Let's hope people check out the website and take a look at this information we've mentioned so they can keep it in mind when they're out there enjoying the summer months when it's nice and warm out there on Lake Michigan or any body of water. There's a potential that somebody can drown, and let's hope it's not you or somebody in your family that becomes the next victim. Dave, thank you very much for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you very much for having us.
A team of students at Calumet College of St. Joseph in Whiting is joining other student groups across the country in preparing experiments that will go aloft in the next flight to the International Space Station. The project's just gotten a monthly award from the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana as well. And I talked with Professor Sandra Shimone Rogers about it, and she says there are two reasons for the experiment.
The first one was to create a new instrument that would be more affordable for high school students, college students, and possibly grade school students to utilize for research and get students interested in scientific research at an earlier age. And the second one was actually to find a preventative for Alzheimer's disease. It is something that's unique, checking to see what an anti-gravity setting can do for such a terrible disease that's out there. And it was actually the Boy Scouts of America that reached out to us, along with CASES, which stands for the Center of Advancement Science, and NASA, that came to us. They had heard about some of the research that we were doing in Northwest Indiana and were intrigued by that.
What were some of the thoughts that led to the discovery that maybe that should be examined further? Is this likelihood that gravity has some kind of impact on the issues that kind of surround Alzheimer's?
Well, it's not so much the Alzheimer's itself, but it's the way water functions in space. And it's so everybody has this protein that exists in their brain, and one way or another, it changes the shape, chemically speaking, structurally, under a molecular level.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to see what would happen with this water molecule, because I don't know if you've ever seen the videos, but there's videos on YouTube that NASA has playing around with water molecules, and they act very different than they do here on Earth. So we thought maybe the peptide, the way it acts in water or in this natural saline solution that's obviously in water with some salt and all this other stuff, we thought maybe that it would act differently in space. And we wanted to see how it would act differently. And if it does, then maybe this is it. This could be the preventative for Alzheimer's disease in itself.
Does this kind of go along with all of the images that we've seen over the years of astronauts either in the space station or out in flight, out there sipping water, and they let little droplets of water float through the air? And you see how funny shapes they are. They're not round, and because they don't have any effect, like gravity doesn't have any effect on them, they don't drop. They just hang out there.
Right. And I don't know if you see, there's also one where they actually add the dye, like food coloring, to that water molecule or that big water bubble. And it doesn't mix like it does here on Earth. It just all of a sudden, boom, turns blue. And we're thinking, well, what if it does that with just food coloring? What does it do to this peptide? And that's the intriguing part. So we don't know how it'll misfold and if it does. And if it does not misfold, so that whole misfolding thing is the reason that Alzheimer's occurs. If it doesn't misfold, then we found it.
What do you and your colleagues there at Calumet College of St. Joseph have had to do to not only work you mentioned it's a project that's kind of gotten started ahead of you, but to work with NASA to be able to create the basis for this experiment, that in turn, and what do you have to do now to be able to get that experiment ready to go up on a private space flight, since NASA doesn't have any space shuttles flying to the International Space Station any longer?
Right. So there's a number of things we had to do. So we're given what's known as a NESI board, and that's like the hard board or hard drive for all the electronical components. And believe it or not, our students are learning all this stuff as they're going, but they're actually learning a little more than what the NESI board is capable of doing. So the NESI board came from Texas A&M. Now, our students became a little more advanced and said, well, the technology that's available on the NESI board wasn't enough for us. We need something else. So they went to some Italian company to get a new motherboard.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things we have to deal with. The other thing is NanoRack supplies us a little box. It's 10 by 10 by 15 centimeters. So it's really small. It's kind of like half of the size of a shoebox. And you have to fit your entire instrument in there along with the experiments. And that itself is a constraint. So that's something else we're dealing with. We have to test for light, like basically how much light goes through it, make sure that nothing shines outside of the box. We have to do a cold storage testing, make sure that once we freeze it, or it's going up into space, so it's going to get cold and then it's going to thaw out again, make sure that none of the hardware or the wires are contaminated or run into any issues with the moisture that does occur.
Mm-hmm.
We do leak testing because our samples are in, like I said, they're going to be in some type of water solution. So we have to make sure that there's nothing that leaks. I don't know, there's like software issues. We've learned that we have new wires. We have to change our wires. So we have to desolder everything, resolder it. There are so many levels with this. And you have to make sure that everything that you use is NASA approved, going all the way from the glue that you use all the way to the different types of cuvettes or the little glass holders of your solution are all NASA approved.
Did you imagine it was going to involve this much work to get to this point?
Not in a million years. But no. It's fun. You're learning a lot, but the amount of thought that's put into everything, they're so detail-oriented. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
But it would have been nice to know ahead of time, I really have to plan out. So all of a sudden they're telling you you can't use these cuvettes, so you got to find something else that works.
Now,
you can't use this memory drive. You got to find another one.
Now, Professor Shimon Rogers, let me ask you, what benefit are you not only getting this learning curve, a steep learning curve that you're going through and getting this project, this experiment ready to go up in the International Space Station, but what about the students? What are they getting out of this that they can use as part of their educational process there at the college, and what they can take out of that too when they graduate?
Well, they're getting a lot out of this. Not only is it a great, obviously, resume builder, but they're learning to think outside, I mean, literally outside the box. Mm-hmm. So they're learning how what they've done in a classroom setting can be applied to something completely new and innovative. And if they don't know something, they're not afraid to ask for help or go look for it somewhere else and then ask for help. And we've even teamed up with, gosh, I can't think of the company name right now, but they're a food processing plant in Valparaiso. Or not processing, but they make all the machinery. But we've worked with them.
Oh, you're talking about Urschel Laboratories?
Urschel, yes. Mm-hmm. Urschel was one that helped us with programming, which was crazy. We would have never thought of that in a million years. But they have the knowledge that we needed to program some of our software. So it creates great collaboration. We've got high school students, college students working with advanced engineers from all across Texas A&M, NASA, CASIS, and then also Urschel. So they're getting a lot out of it. They're learning new math skills, new science skills, things that we can't just teach them in a classroom, but actually apply it and see how to do it.
Now, since this project is still ongoing, what is the timetable that you and everybody else involved in this project getting the experiment ready to go? When is the scheduled flight?
It's supposed to launch off the first week of August. We were postponed a little bit because of some of the other space export stuff that blew up. So
yeah, they've had some share of problems in trying to get flights up there too. I'm aware
of
that.
That's
got to have an impact on just kind of shifts the schedule back and delays things even more, I would imagine.
It does, and then we also have to be prepared. We're preparing doubles of everything. Mm-hmm. So in case one doesn't make it, we have a backup with us when we go.
Looking forward to finding out how this experiment does going up. And once you get it up there, if things go as scheduled, how quickly are you hoping to get some word of results back?
30 days. Within 30 days, we can process the data within a day, and hopefully we'll get results out to the public within a month after that. So probably 60 days total, 2 months.
That's wonderful. We've been talking with Professor Sandra Shimon Rogers from the Calumet College of St. Joseph's, who along with a group of students and others and part of a team are working with NASA preparing for an experiment that is going to go up this summer to the International Space Station. Thank you very much for showing your information to us. And we not only congratulate you for that work, but also too for picking up an innovation award because of it from the Society of Innovators from Northwest Indiana. Thanks for being with us to talk about it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate this greatly.
Latest concern that law enforcement, addiction treatment centers, and the public face in the battle against opioids is called gray death. It's a deadly concoction of gravel-like heroin that was first reported in southern states and spreading across the country. The drug is so powerful that it can be absorbed into the body by merely touching it. Valerie Thorne with the Recovery Works Addiction Treatment Facility in Merrillville talked with us recently about the gray death, why it's so dangerous, and how her facility and others like it are dealing with the effects of that, as well as trying to fight it and helping bring addicts back to their families.
One of the things is we recently have seen that gray death is resistant to Narcan. A large part of that is because it is includes carfentanil, which is much stronger than the fentanyl we have in this country. And so it has been headed to our area. We have seen it in Ohio, Kentucky, and Pennsylvania, and just recently in Indianapolis. And so it is impacting our community. We have seen a few patients whom we've had to administer in this region 5 to 6 times of the Narcan before it was effective. So it is in the region.
I have heard one description of how potent carfentanil is that a single flake of it could anesthetize an elephant. Is this pretty true? It's not very far-fetched?
That is very true.
Sounds like this is something that I guess of carfentanil. We've known about fentanyl for quite some time, and I know it's shown up here in Northwest Indiana. Is this a new introduction of something stronger? And if it is, where does it seem to be coming from?
Well, and from the police reports, it appears that it is coming from overseas, and it's coming through customs. And so with that being said, it has a tendency to get past a lot of the things that we have as safeguards here in this country. And so it is coming up through some of the southern states, mm-hmm. according to the police reports that I have read.
From what you understand, how can this get past the customs? Is it just a way that they can, because of what it is, they can smuggle it around other ways that maybe aren't easy to touch? Or maybe the drug testing methods that are out there don't detect it?
Well, I would not be able to speak to that because mm-hmm. that would be a U.S. Customs thing. I couldn't say why it's coming through. But as it's been in this country for such a long time, there are many different ways that people learn how to get it through.
One of the things in the article in CNN talks about in more detail, in talking with people that they had talked to, forensic chemists and the like, and they mentioned about this, the problem about whether they determined it's some kind of compound that they hadn't yet discovered. But apparently, as you say, at least the components of it have been around for a while.
Correct.
Is there any reason why maybe it's just now, we're just learning now about the Gray Death?
Probably because I would presume that when people utilize these substances, that they experiment with different substances when they're mixing it. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't speak to that, but we would presume that based on the compounds that are coming up with Gray Death.
Okay. When folks come into the Recovery Works facility in Maryville, they have problems, and you talk with them and counsel with them and then get them help, because the facility, by the way, is a multifaceted treatment facility. Not only is taking care of outpatients, but there's also a residential program as well, too. How do all the programs that Recovery Works have available to them help with these people and not necessarily dealing with such a strong compound as this Gray Death, but just the, hate to say, run-of-the-mill opioids that you run into every single day?
Well, sadly, when an individual takes this substance, many individuals wind up dead because the drug is Narcan resistant. And as I said earlier, you know, 5 to 6 times before somebody is able to reverse the overdose. But people believe that they're actually taking heroin when they're taking the fentanyl. Mm-hmm. And that's the issue that we have, or the carfentanil. And both are lethal substances. Our hope is to get them into treatment, okay, prior to, more of a prevention before they get the substance, because they don't know what they're getting. And so we want to get them into treatment. And our phone number is 866-535-HOPE. And so one of the things is getting them into treatment, educating them on the treatment, providing them the services that they need through detox, residential, counseling, and also through our intensive outpatient program, so that they can follow that process to help them so that they're not using substances. So we want to get them before they have the accident of the carfentanil or the Gray Death.
So obviously you're talking about people that somehow or another have become addicted to heroin, certainly, or cocaine, and heroin in particular, because you say that the heroin and these fentanyl, carfentanil, they're so much alike, they look alike. And somebody, as you say, somebody could overdose or get hold of it even and not know what they're getting.
Correct. That is correct. And so we're hoping to get them into treatment before, and with all of the news explaining right now that, you know, Gray Death and carfentanil and all of these things are a real concern, hoping that people will come into treatment before they accidentally get that substance.
I guess, although fortunate for us, not for the people that live in those areas, but I guess most of the deaths that have been reported from the Gray Death so far from carfentanil have happened in the South. And I guess because you mentioned that's what the area where it seems to have gotten its way into the country is in through the South. And I guess we're getting alerts all across the country now from this problem that's cropped up down in Alabama and other states down there.
That is very true. And so because of that, we also have treatment facilities in Ohio, Kentucky, Pennsylvania. We're actually opening up some new facilities because this is a very dangerous situation. And young people are dying and people who don't realize what they're getting in the substances that they're purchasing.
How difficult has it been for the chemists and the forensic analysts to, once they get wind of this substance that's out there, how difficult is it for them to try to look into it further and see what much damage it really can do? Is it relatively easy, or is it because things have happened so quickly that it's just kind of overwhelmed everybody?
And I believe that it's the latter, uh-huh. that it has just overwhelmed everybody. It wasn't anything that they were expecting that we were going to be dealing with in such a short period of time.
We're talking with Valerie Thorne, who is the executive director of the Recovery Works facility in Northwest Indiana. They're based in Merivale. It's a facility that offers not only outpatient, residential, and transitional living services to people that have drug abuse problems, trying to help them get out of the situation that they are in. And it sounds like with some of these very, very potent, very serious drugs, to just keep them alive. When we're having issues like this, that we come across these new drugs, or at least they're we're discovering them new. They're not new, as you say. Carfentanil have been around for a while. Is there anything that the authorities can do, since they're dealing with this? And we just talked about this one example of the police officer from Ohio who accidentally overdosed himself because he had fentanyl on his clothing, not knowing what he actually had, although he knew it was probably drugs of some type. When we're dealing with this, and it only took, hopefully, it helped this one officer out with the several doses of Narcan. Police officers that come across this every single day, certainly here in Northwest Indiana and other places, don't keep that much, Narcan or related drugs around to be able to help deal with these sudden dose overdoses like this. What can they do, or what are they hoping they're going to be able to do?
Well, I do know that the overdose out of Indianapolis is really working to get a lot of the individuals and facilities, as well as police department, fire department, all of them to have Narcan on them. So they're working very diligently. And we're working with the police departments and law enforcement and communities to bring awareness to the dangers to get these people in for treatment before it is too late. So one of the things I recommend is for friends, neighbors, family, to actually be on the lookout for any of their friends, family members, or neighbors who that might be impacted. Mm-hmm. I know sometimes people don't want to address the issue of drugs, but it's in the news every single day. And so I encourage them to seek treatment before they come into contact with the substance. So working with the police department, working with all of the school systems and things along that line to help get these people into treatment before it is too late.
Are there any warning signs? I think we always think that there are signs we see of people that have been taking cocaine or they're on heroin, and there are signs that you can tell if somebody is having problems. Is there anything that anybody can do or be aware of? Any warning signs, I suppose, before they get involved so heavily into something that they can kill them almost instantly?
Well, it would have to be, changes in behaviors. And we always talked about, opiates starting out in actually the home where people have leftover prescriptions. And I know that they're working for medication-assisted treatment for these individuals. So trying to help them understand, if you don't have any medications that you have left over, please discard them appropriately. And I know the police departments are working to have that happen as well so that they don't have these opiates, because a lot of times it happens in the home and people don't realize that just having those old prescriptions are part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. That's the long-standing problem. We say people always have leftover prescriptions, and before we were just dealing with just some things that just, were basically just mild painkillers to get over some surgery or some other problems like that. But now we're talking into much, much more potent, more dangerous drugs, I suppose, that people are taking, I guess, and they, some of them, I'm sure, can't wean themselves off it after they've gotten rid of the pain from whatever they've had, either surgery or broken bones or something like that.
And a lot of people don't understand that some of the opiates that we have out there are very, very addictive from the first time you take them. And so with that being said, the old adage about what an addict looked like is not the same as it is today. Mm-hmm. And so with that being said, one of the things that we try to do is help people understand that once they take the medication, okay, whether it's for surgery or whatever reason, that there is the potential for them to get addicted because it is so powerful. And so what we want them to do is understand that they have to be the ones to say, I'm not going to do this. I'm moving forward. I'm only going to take a few of them, because it can be very difficult for them to get off of it. And an addict that we used to think of is not the addict of today. They can be from just taking one prescription of medication, and then they can become addicted.
It's Valerie Thorne with the Recovery Works Addiction Treatment Center in Merivale. The narcotics problem here in Lake County oftentimes blends in with crime activity, and the data shows up in the annual Lake County Drug Task Force report. Lake County Sheriff John Buncich came on Regionally Speaking earlier in the year to talk about the 2016 report.
We made a lot of changes the first of last year. as far as personnel is concerned and operations, and the amount of seizures virtually are up 100% over 2015. The seizures amounted to almost $1.3 million. The vehicles that have been impounded, the weapons that were recovered, it's just these numbers are phenomenal. I attribute it, again, to some good leadership over there and some concerted efforts. It's made up of our officers from the Sheriff's Department and some of the Gary officers also. We work very, very closely with the Gary Police Department, as you know, in other areas, also with the Metro Homicide Unit. And we've put our efforts in that direction, working together, combined, and it's proven very, very effective.
When we're talking about seizures, we're talking about a lot of drugs here. Give us an idea of the range of the drugs that have been taken by the task force team members during this year of 2016 and how that has helped in getting some of the problems that we face here with cocaine and heroin and other drugs off the street.
Well, we're talking crack cocaine, red cocaine, powder cocaine, ecstasy. Just ecstasy alone, you know, that's called a date rape drug. We seized almost over 11,000 pills. You know, that's unbelievable. Heroin, I don't have to tell you how bad the heroin epidemic is right now in Lake County, Lake and Porter County, how many young men and women are dying of overdoses. We've had a recent situation where some of the heroin was being sold laced with that drug fentanyl, and that's a deadly drug. And it mixed with heroin, it causes almost instantaneous death, overdose death. So we've increased our efforts in heroin, enforcement. Marijuana is always something there. Prescription pills, Xanax, and those type of things. Thousands and thousands of pills that we've been seizing. One that I want to call your attention to is that we had in and around the Crown Point High School,
mm-hmm.
where they were delivering and selling openly, an individual selling to high school kids, and they had a real major ring going, and selling the Xanax and other and synthetic marijuana and other types of prescription pills.
I understand the 20-year-old from Crown Point, Petar Zelkov, is facing criminal charges now.
You got it, him, and then we did a recent roundup just prior to the holidays, prior to Christmas, and we've out of 32 warrants we had, we've located over half of them already. And one of those individuals that we arrested was involved with that ring, distribution ring, in and around the high school.
We know that a lot of the work can't be done, it's above board, so to speak. Have to rely a lot on individuals across Northwest Indiana in getting tips off to the drug task force that in turn will lead to not only the discovery of the drugs, but also the arrests is made, too. Well, a lot of anonymous tips that have to be made that
you
help
got
out.
It. And that's what, you know, we have established our hotline number, and the amount of information we receive. Almost 300 calls.
Wow.
We've received of tips. So we're encouraging the public to, continue this. Like I've said before, I established this during my first term as sheriff in 1995, and the hotline number. We don't want to know who you are. We don't have caller ID or anything else, but give us some information. It's proven very effective. They're the eyes and ears for the police department in the neighborhood. They know what's going on. Give us a license plate number. Give us a name. Give us an address. What you suspect is illegal activity. We check each and every one of them out. So it's very, very important that, that this cooperative effort among the public in general. There's been federal prosecutions, federal indictments on individuals who are the hierarchy of the gang. The gangs in this area, whether it be the Latin Kings, the Disciples, the Two Sixers, or whatever it may be. All right, but our philosophy is, you know, they've got that level underneath that hierarchy are the ones that are committing the homicides, wreaking havoc in these neighborhoods, the drug activity, prostitution, and everything else. We're targeting those individuals primarily, and that's why it's paid off for us. Because, you know, the... these poor citizens in some of these neighborhoods, especially in the urban areas of Lake County up north, you know, they're looking at individuals. They don't know who the hierarchy of these gangs are. They're looking at the ones that are sitting on the corner are doing drive-by shootings in their neighborhood. These are the ones that we're targeting, and we're going to continue to target.
Lake County Sheriff John Bonsich. It's Monday, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts with Eye on the Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Eric Rolden, who is an unwanted artist.
That's right.
But it's not you're not unwanted with an A.
No, there's a
very much wanted in that sense.
I think we got something going on, yeah. It's just a little typo, if you will. It's a real word. People don't use it anymore.
Yeah.
It's unwanted with an O instead of an A.
Unwanted.
Yeah.
W-O-N-T-E-D.
That's us.
So what does that mean?
Unwanted, that's, you know, it's a fun little word that my good buddy Jeffrey Brink found on the internet. And its meaning is not customary or usual. It means memorable. It means out of the ordinary. It means uncommon. That was the birthing, what we named our baby of our art group that we've put together.
And you put this group together, what, about 3 or 4 years ago?
Yeah, it's been about 3 years. Our very first exhibit as a group was the fall of 2014 over at Substation Number 9.
Mm-hmm.
Granted us... In part by you. That was a fun little thing. Six artists. You know, we became friends at the IUN, Indiana University Northwest, mm-hmm. Fine Arts Program. And later, through, you know, a little bit of fine place luck and some serendipity, we got the chance to put on our own art show in our very own way,
mm-hmm.
which was important because our goal as an artist collective is to renovate the fine art gallery going experience for
mm-hmm.
people who live in the region.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're setting out to do.
So Substation Number 9, for those who don't know, is a branch of South Shore Arts, mm-hmm. where I work in Munster. It's a branch that we opened 19 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we use it for pop-up events and special exhibits from time to time. And one of your colleagues in the Unwanted, Veronica,
mm-hmm.
Napoli.
That's her.
Veronica is one of the original Unwanted. Are you all? Is it all the original group that's still together?
It is. We went from 6 over to 8, and then life happens, and then mm-hmm. we're back at the original 6.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, and she had worked for us at Substation.
She was there. That was her stomping grounds.
Yeah, and she approached us about putting this
yes.
event on,
yes.
Take It Outside.
That's it.
And the first year, you had really cold, rainy weather.
First year was Northwest Indiana's monsoon.
Uh-huh.
There's a nice little wind tunnel that's built into the city over there, and we decided to erect a 20 by 20 tent.
Uh-huh.
My job was supposed to be that day photographer, videographer, but mm-hmm. I was the guy that made sure the thing didn't blow down.
I see.
The street.
With the people in it.
Yeah. So that was my job.
And then last year you moved it back a couple weeks or so from May to June.
We did adjust it, hoping for better weather. And we got sweatsuits. Everybody wore sweatsuits that day. So by request, we doubled up on the bottled water availability uh-huh. this year, trying to fix a couple things. So
so it's on June what?
June 10th is the third annual Take It Outside pop-up outdoor gallery, live art and music fest. It's going to go from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m.,
mm-hmm.
right when the sun's out, substation.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And that's right in downtown Hammond. Over there is Paul Henry's Art Gallery.
Yep.
Over there is 18th Street Brewery,
yep.
For anybody who's familiar with the goings-on over there.
Mm-hmm. And Toll Theater.
That's right. Toll Theater is a big sponsor and supporter of what we've got going on.
Good.
And they host art events themselves. They'll turn
yeah.
their lobby into a gallery.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're lucky enough to have them on our roster of people who clap their hands for us.
So what would if one goes to Take It Outside, what might one expect?
Yeah, so this is the third one. It's the biggest one we're having so far in our little bitty history. And so what we've got going on is for full public viewing, full participation is a big thing with the Unwanted. We want people to come and get their hands dirty figuratively and literally while making art. So
mm-hmm.
that's our thing. We're going to have 2 fine art galleries. We're going to have 4 hours of live music from 4 acts. We're going to have 3 live artists in different stations, and one of them is going to be perusing around painting people's faces and bodies per request. You know, a dozen yeah. artists and vendors with their handcrafted goods. You can find them online and at our location. The Grindhouse Cafe food truck is going to be serving hot and cold food and drink, and the Unwanted Raffle, where you're going to be able to win art prizes. prizes as well as gift certificates from a lot of our sponsors, which include the Toll, 18th Street Brewery, Stella V Cafe, who's also a new opening cafe in downtown Hammond.
Okay.
And also the South Shore Arts provided interactive art project. Most times that's a kid-friendly for our family-friendly event, good, which is taken outside.
And I think I saw in the brochure that 18th Street Brewer is doing an unofficial after party this
year. Yes. They were way too busy. Way too busy opening up that location last year.
Yeah.
We approached them last year and because we had some history with them over in Miller Beach when they first opened.
Right.
And so they got adjusted and they're willing to go this year all out.
Yeah.
So we're going to have an unofficial after party for Take It Outside. We're calling it TO3. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be three bands. That's Club Mallows from Chicago. That's Evil Waves from Valparaiso. And probably the infamous Gun from the region area. A lot of people know them. They're loud. That's going to be crazy. That's not family friendly at all.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
John Kane talking with Eric Roldan about the upcoming Take It Outside pop-up outdoor gallery, live art, and music fest that is happening in Hammond this coming weekend on Saturday, June 10th. Tune in every Monday for Eye on the Arts Conversations here on Regionally Speaking. You can hear this conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts 2 on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We will be recording tonight's community forum at Purdue University Northwest, and that is what you get to hear tomorrow on Regionally Speaking.